Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. You're going to be hearing about a gratifying success story in Kenosha Unified, the success that has been enjoyed at Frank Elementary School. You'll be meeting the principal and two tutors on the staff in just a moment. We wanted to offer a brief word of clarification. The report cards that come down from the Wisconsin DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, since 2015 have undergone a slight change in the way they are calculated. Schools that do have populations with large numbers of students in poverty have their numbers slightly weighted. That being said, that does not diminish the scope of this success story at Frank Elementary School, and we're really happy to share this story with you on today's morning show. Here are the guests. It is always gratifying when we can talk about an exciting success story in the sector of public education, and particularly when we can talk about a school that in so many ways has all kinds of strikes against it and yet rises to one challenge after another in really thrilling fashion. That is the story, the feel-good story of Frank Elementary School in Kenosha Unified. This is what we would call an inner city school with a high poverty population for its student body. And this is exactly the kind of school where so often we hear sort of unhappy stories about, among other things, the achievement gap that we hear so much about. But in the case of Frank Elementary School, in fact, this school has done astounding things. And in fact, in the most recent batch of report cards from the DPI, which rate schools on some of the most important factors of achieving student success, Frank Elementary was the most successful, highest-ranked elementary school in Kenosha Unified. So it was really the suggestion of our news director, Dave McGrath, that we talk to somebody from Frank Elementary and see just what is behind the great success which they have managed to achieve there. So we have three guests with us today from Frank Elementary, beginning with Heather Connolly, who is the principal there, Luann Daniels, who is an instructional coach, and Karen Geese, who is a Title I literacy coach. And all of them have been at Frank in various capacities for over 20 years. So they know this school well. It is obviously near and dear to their collective hearts. And they are in the trenches each and every day making this success a reality. So I'm very excited that they have made time in their very busy schedules to join me today on the morning show to talk about Frank Elementary School and how this great success has been achieved and is being sustained. Heather Connolly, Luann Daniels, Karen Geese, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Really, really do appreciate that you can all be here. One of the things I think is interesting is the fact that you all have been there for such a long time. And I wonder if you could just say a word, whoever wants to begin, about what Frank Elementary School was like more than 20 years ago compared to what it's like today.
Well, I can start.
Here's Heather.
When I started back in the early 90s, the school was still almost the original building. We had not gone through our remodel and our addition. Poverty level was about 85 to 88%. We're currently at about 95%.
Wow.
So it was still a high poverty school. Minority-wise, we were almost one-third African-American, one-third Hispanic, and one-third Caucasian. Now we're about 40% to 42% of the Hispanic and African-American and about 8% Caucasian. So we've changed a little, although we've always been very diverse. We were very lucky because we worked, all of us, under Gordy Hess, who was the principal there for 20 years. So he left quite a legacy, and we all had an opportunity to work together and work for him, which was certainly a perk. Anyone that's gotten a chance to work with Gordy would, I'm sure, say the same thing. And it was a little bit smaller. I'd say it was a two-track school, meaning that there were two classrooms for every grade level, and now we're a three-track school. So slightly bigger, newly remodeled, a little different, but pretty much the same.
How about in terms of success? I mean, are you building on something that was largely successful back then, or was this a school that was struggling in the way that so many schools with that kind of population struggle?
I would say that I definitely did not inherit an issue or a problem. I mean, this was a strong community-based school. The staff has always been extremely close. The struggle with rating schools is that the measure to rate how we do as a school changes constantly. So prior to 6 years ago, when we went through a transformation, we had made quite a bit of progress. And then the state came in and changed how they called it the change in the cut score. So they had four categories for achievement. They had advanced, proficient, basic, and minimal. And they made a determination that the test wasn't as rigorous as they wanted, so they just took all the scores and moved them lower to a different category. So we had had a pretty high success, and then by one decision, ultimately, everybody was moved down a category. And that was very detrimental to a school like ours, because the majority of our kids were in that middle section of basic and advanced or proficient. And when we moved, we were shifted to the lowest end of the scale. So I find with the way that we measure schools, we have this interesting ability to start to gain success, and then we change the measure. And so we've had a different state test now. This is what, our 3 years in a row. So it's been a struggle, because you're continually comparing completely different tests to try to determine how you are as a school. So I wouldn't say that we were always necessarily a failing school, but when you work with a population of students that come into your building with some academic and behavioral challenges and some delays, it's going to make it a difficult journey to be measured by kids who are coming to school with parents that have degrees in education and kids that have had years and years of preschool and exposure to learning. That's a difficult measurement. I mean, we could measure our own children compared to the children we work with and know that.
Right. So in other words, you're in so many cases not working with students who are starting at square one, but
Correct.
More like negative one or negative two, and might be bearing all kinds of burdens before they ever walk in the door.
Correct.
Right. I'm curious about how each of you found your way to Frank Elementary, and if this was the kind of school that you envisioned yourself teaching in or working in. Let's start with the other two. How about Luann Daniels? You are the instructional coach at Frank, and you've been there more than 20 years. Is that what you've
that
done there
right.
the whole time?
Actually, I started there as the math specialist or math resource teacher, and in that position, I had the opportunity to co-teach with teachers. I would go into their classroom. We would set a plan and go in. I would teach with them, and we would find the best practices or the practices that created the most success for the students. And I did that for, well, I've been an instructional coach, I think, the last 6 years, so the entire time I was there.
Mm-hmm. How about being in a school like Frank? I mean, is that the kind of school in which you envisioned yourself working and wanted to be in? I mean, with all the challenges that are part of it?
I'm not sure that that's what I envisioned, but once I was there, I love teaching at Frank, and I couldn't envision myself anywhere else or working with any other population. I really, truly do care.
Karen Geese?
I started my career in a northern Wisconsin school, and then I moved back to Kenosha, which is my hometown, and I was lucky enough to know some staff, and Gordy hired me as a third grade teacher. And I think I taught third grade for 3 or 4 years, moved down to second grade, then I moved down to first grade. and then through that time, I had my first child and received my reading specialist, my 316 license, and then Heather and I moved into job sharing at first grade, and then we moved into the reading first coordinator position, and then I've kind of been a resource teacher for the last, I believe, 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
supporting teachers and classrooms for raising student achievement and literacy.
You must have really experienced a huge culture shift, I should think, from wherever it was you taught before to
teaching in Marinette. All I needed was to look at a student, and the behavior changed. So it was pretty much of a culture shock for me when I came to Frank. Those first couple months, I remember, were pretty rough. But once I really got to know the students and the families, just like Luann and Heather, I love teaching at Frank. I think I've always felt that we need the best teachers at Frank. And either at Frank School and teaching poverty, students of poverty, is a good fit for you, or it isn't. I know that for me personally, I want to give the students at Frank everything that I give my children. Because, like we mentioned, like I give my own children. Because our students that come into kindergarten, they're so far behind. Having 4K at our building has really improved the skills, especially in literacy and numeracy, that our kindergarten students are coming into. But in the past, our students are already sometimes 2 years behind their peers in Kenosha. So we have, like Heather said, a long journey to bring them up to grade level.
Wow. Heather, how did you, Heather Connolly again is the principal at Frank. How did you end up there? And was that part of some master plan that was just inevitably where you were going to be in a school like Frank?
It was certainly not a master plan that I thought of. I also grew up in Kenosha, but I attended St. Mark's and St. Joe's and then went on to Carthage. So definitely not the same track as Frank. When I graduated from Carthage, my next door neighbor was the special ed teacher at Frank, and she was leaving to help open Stoker Elementary. And she said, "You need to apply for my job." I had a special ed license and an elementary ed, and you would love working for Gordy. You'd love Frank. You just need to go apply. So I did, and I went in the summer. The school was completely empty except for Gordy, and sat and had an interview and was then offered the job. And I often laugh that I don't know if I would have hired me 23 years ago. Uh-huh. I was really, really culturally shocked. And I remember the first day of school, really standing in this new building, this place, and realizing that there was a whole culture and a whole neighborhood that I had no experience and understanding. And I even felt a sense of shame that I had grown up in this community and city and really had no idea that Frank existed, or that poverty was what it was and what it looked like. So I really, at that point, immersed myself in the PTO, and my mother and I started a Girl Scout troop and just became really passionate about I need to learn what I didn't know. And with that, quickly, just like Karen and Luann, fell in love with the school and the opportunities that I've had there, teaching special ed, working in a classroom, being able to job share part-time for 8 years while my kids were little was an amazing opportunity. My husband and I adopted a child from Frank, so we have 4 children, and one of them is our daughter who was adopted. And that's an amazing experience. I mean, what a gift that we were given, even, you know, just by being in that building. So it definitely is part of who we are.
I'm curious, too, what in particular prompted you to take, I mean, maybe it's just a little step, but to me it seems like it would be a leap from being a teacher to being the principal. I mean, what about the office of a principal was appealing to you?
Well, I think it really goes back to my background. My father's mom was a teacher, and she opened a preschool in Kenosha way back in the day at St. Mary's Lutheran. It was called We Scholars. And I spent a ton of time growing up when I had days off working at grandma's school. So she was really like that first person that I remember leading a school that was a woman. And so getting to work with her was always pretty exciting. When I went away to college, I originally went into pre-law, and I remember a very pivotal conversation with my father when I called him up and said, "I don't think this is for me. I'm here at Marquette. I feel lost. I can't believe that I'm in this program. Dad, I think I really want to teach." And I remember him saying, "Yeah, we know. We've always known. We just needed you to figure it out. Hmm. And he said, plus, I think someday you'll be a principal. And I was like, no, no, no. And then about a year into teaching, Gordy called me in my office, into his office, now my office, and said, have you thought about a master's program? I said, yeah, I'm looking at different master's program. He goes, you need to go into a principal program, administrative. And I was like, really? You think so? Absolutely. So I started looking at that path. So really with the encouragement of my dad and then of Gordy, really recognizing that leadership was part of who I was. I was always class president and, you know, in different leadership positions. So that wasn't something new either. But they really encouraged me to pursue.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on the morning show with three staff members from Frank Elementary School, which is an inner city school that's part of Kenosha Unified. Heather Connolly, whom we were just hearing from, is the principal there. We also have with us in the studios Luann Daniels, an instructional coach, and Karen Geese, a Title I literacy coach at Frank Elementary. Frank Elementary scored the highest on the DPI report card among all the elementary schools in Kenosha Unified. Am I saying that correctly?
No.
Okay.
I wasn't sure when to interrupt on that. So we scored an 87.2 on the score on the report card. There were 9 schools in KUSD that received 5 stars. We were one of them. I don't know the exact order, but I believe Roosevelt had the highest score, and then it may have been Brompton and K-Tech. So we're up in the middle, but we're one of 9 that had 5 stars.
That got the top rating.
Correct.
Okay, so
but
I'm
not the top, but
right, gotcha.
9 of the top.
Although we should probably also hasten to add that given the circumstances and location of your school and its population and so on, to achieve 5
right.
stars is really an amazing achievement. And
thank
so
you.
That's what we're talking about. But yeah, thank you for the clarification. We don't want those other schools coming after us with pitchforks.
Give them credit.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And of course, this is a tough business everywhere.
Absolutely.
But of course, you're facing especially stiff challenges. Let's talk about that. Let's try to kind of get some sense of the reality with which you and all of the teachers at Frank and in schools like it mm-hmm. are dealing with on kind of a daily basis. And then some of the strategies that you have been utilizing to close the so-called achievement gap. Let's talk first of all on sort of the issue of what you were touching on, the fact that so many of your students come perhaps from homes where education has not necessarily been a high priority, or where there are all kinds of factors that sort of get in the way that mm-hmm. might not be in the way in other households. What are some really tangible examples of that in which a given student might really be hobbled in terms of achieving the success that another student might all but take for granted?
I would say one of the biggest problems we face is the beginning stages of learning, which is meeting the hierarchy of needs, the shelter, the clothing, the food, the things that we tend to take for granted. Many of our kids are living in poverty, obviously in poverty, but they're living in homeless situations, or they're living where they might be staying at one home for a couple days and then they're at another home, or they might be in shelter care. We are the homeschool currently for any child that's living in the INS program or in the Shalom Center.
So if a child is
mm-hmm,
there,
mm-hmm.
then they go to Frank.
Right, right. And for people that aren't aware of what the INS program is, it's certainly a wonderful service, but it has its own challenges. So if there's no room in shelter and you don't have a place to stay, you can sleep in the gymnasium of a different church each night. So you get on a bus at about 7 o'clock at night. You go to a different church. There are volunteers there. You sleep in the gym. And then at 7 in the morning, you pack up your things and you are dropped off at the Shalom Center. And you are then free to roam for the rest of the day. The challenges with that is only one of the churches actually has a laundry. So on the night that you're in that church, mom might not be sleeping because she'll be in line to do laundry. And one of the churches has showering facilities. So you may only get a shower once a week. So that's some challenges.
Mm.
And so imagine then if you're living in the INS program and you're staying in a gymnasium, and it's usually a different church each night, you don't have a bedroom, you don't have a place to keep books, you don't have a computer to play games on, there's probably not a TV to watch. So that in itself is certainly a challenge. You may not always sleep well. There can be interruptions in the nighttime because sometimes the police will bring teenagers that may have run away. They'll drop them there that night, trying to reunite them with their family. So that in itself is a challenge. That's a plug for anybody that's trying to support the Shalom Center, because that's why they're trying to get a larger permanent place, so that they'll have an overnight residential space. So that's certainly a challenge. We have quite a few kids that are living in homes of grandparents and friends, sleeping on couches, sharing beds. It's hard to imagine what that can be like. And then to come to school and expected to read at grade level or write a 5-paragraph page paper is not necessarily the easiest thing to accomplish. I'm taking over here, but I would say that meeting the basic needs of our students is really where we start. We feed breakfast to every student in the morning when they arrive. More schools have joined that program. I worked with Cindy Gossett over at Food Services to convert from a hot breakfast program to a cold program a few years ago, because we looked at our numbers of kids that were eating the hot breakfast. It was only about 18%, and yet 95% qualified. So we looked at how can we get more kids to eat. And so now we actually deliver a cold breakfast every morning to the classroom. We also wrote a grant for fresh fruit and vegetables. So 3 times a week from the National Dairy Act, we receive different fruits and vegetables from farmers in Wisconsin. It's sort of a payback program. So the grant pays the farmers for the food. Some of the different organizations in the Milwaukee area help to prepare the food, and then the kids get a snack. We also have an after-school snack for our after-school program, and then children receive a hot lunch through the National Food Program. So feeding kids, keeping them safe. We have a school uniform that we help to provide. Anybody that's homeless, we provide them with a uniform. We have an exchange program. We have a buyback program. Again, another way to keep kids on the same playing level, to give the message that when you're at school, this is your job. So you come in uniform because you're here to work and you're here to do your job and have the level playing field. So we start with just the basic needs and lots of love.
I wanted to ask you about the matter of uniforms. How long has that been in place?
This is our 6th year. Okay. We kind of went through a transformation 6 years ago, and uniforms was part of that.
Can you tell us what went into that decision?
For the transformation?
Specifically for uniforms.
So when we were creating this transformation idea, we were looking at creating a charter school because we wanted to have a middle school program. And when we were writing this, we started surveying parents and asking them. That's where the calendar that we're on was born. We started asking questions about summer school. We started asking questions about a school uniform. We asked questions about what they were looking for in an after-school program. So we used some of the results from the survey to create this plan. And at the time, 85% of the parents wanted that uniform.
Wow.
It wasn't even something that was as passionate from the staff as it was the parents at the time.
You know, a lot of parents comment that there's no arguments in the morning.
Mm.
It's a red, navy blue, or white shirt. It's khaki or navy blue pants, and there's no arguing.
Interesting.
And not a lot of their budget has to go towards clothes, if you think about it, especially since we have so many that are donated, and our students can do a swap if they have outgrown their uniforms. They can come in. We have a whole table set up for them to do that. So
parents can exchange.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
For new sizes.
But you can buy a school uniform for $10 if you go to Walmart. You can get a pair of pants and a shirt for $10 to $12. That helps parents quite a bit.
Let's talk for a moment about the issue of discipline at a place like like Frank. So I think a lot of people with not a lot of daily contact with students of this type probably leap to some assumptions about the way they behave or don't behave when they are at school. So maybe you should disavow us of some of those assumptions and generalizations, while at the same time, you know, painting mm-hmm. a realistic picture of what you are dealing with when it comes to those kind of issues.
Well, I think the biggest change for us was when we went, it used to be known as Expeditionary Learning, now it's EL Education. It's a program that Harborside, a network of schools that Harborside is a part of, and we joined that network 6 years ago. And in EL schools, you have two tracks. You have your crew culture and your instruction. So that was really a transformation for us with discipline, because we went to the point of every single classroom begins the day in a morning meeting where everybody is greeted, everybody is acknowledged, and everybody's in the same place. And we teach character traits, and we teach them throughout the year every single day. So it's not just a set of classroom rules. What I would say about discipline is that you have to, when you walk into a high poverty school, understand that kids will be kids, and whether they're poor or not, they're going to sometimes use inappropriate language. Some of them are going to argue. Some of them are going to refuse to do work. Some of them might be physical with each other. That happens everywhere. The difference for our kids is they're conditioned in some ways that that's a little bit more normal. So when one of my own children might use an inappropriate word, they're not going to do it in front of me. And if they do, they realize, oh, man, I'm in trouble.
I shouldn't have done that.
Right. Yeah. Where some of our kids at Frank hear language such as that on a normal basis. So when they say something inappropriate, they aren't necessarily prepared that that's wrong or that they're going to get. You have to teach that. And so if you walk into a classroom and you expect that a kid is going to do what you tell them to do simply because you told them to do it, you're going to have a really rough day. You need to learn that it's about teaching. So we teach and teach and teach behaviors.
Right.
And a community, I would say.
Yes.
Say that again?
Building a community.
Those relationships.
That crew meeting in the morning where the teacher's greeting them, the students are greeting each other. There's that sense of community, that the classroom is together. I think, again, the uniforms help. We're all the same. We're together at Frank as a big family. I think most people are surprised when they come into our building. They expect, kind of like you said, the negative stereotypes. We're in our classrooms. We're learning. We're engaged. And the teachers do need to use kind of out-of-the-box strategies at Frank, because we need to keep our students engaged and excited, and it requires a different level of teaching than another school.
I think we went back to building that community has been so instrumental, because when students feel part of that classroom and they feel safe, that allows for instruction to be given at a higher level, because the kids feel safe. They feel safer to take risks. They feel safer to express their opinions. But that all goes back to building that community. Yeah. So we've done that.
Well, and a big challenge for us is students that might have challenges with mental health issues or ADHD issues have a harder time getting outside services. Either they don't have insurance, they don't have transportation. So in a school where you have parents that have insurance or transportation or can either put them into treatment or if medication is needed can provide that, oftentimes we don't have those resources for our families. And so that tends to be where some of the biggest struggle with discipline can be, is how do you support a child that could potentially, for example, be on medication for 30 days and the prescription runs out and mom has no transportation, and now they're going through a change because they either are withdrawing from the medication they were on, or the medication that helped them focus and attend is no longer there, and now you have to use different strategies. So that's really where we try to support teachers with how can we provide breaks for kids that need breaks, and what types of hands-on manipulatives or stress relievers, or we have kids with earphones, we have kids with, every classroom has a refocus area, a quiet space that when you're angry or upset, you can go to before the office is called to intervene. So we have steps to support the kids before it's just calling the office and saying, come get this child.
Right.
And that just goes right back to the teaching. Teaching children how they can deal with those feelings. They don't come to us knowing in many cases.
Right.
It has to be taught.
Right.
Right. And it's everybody. I mean, you know, my friends here are certainly very strong in reading and math, but that there's not a time where they're not working with a student that's struggling or in a classroom, or, you know, they might be working with a teacher and there's a child in there that's having an issue, and they'll jump in just like I would to help support. So everybody, it's hands-on for everybody.
Right. As you're talking about this student population that is with such high poverty numbers, and I was staggered to hear that. I mean, I knew it was a high poverty school, but I didn't realize we were talking about up into the 90s. And mm-hmm. I just think about the elementary school I went to, you know, 1,000 years ago in a little town in Iowa, and how there would be a couple of students, maybe mm-hmm. two or three in a class of, I don't know, 25, that where one had a pretty good sense that they come from a very poor home. And, of course, in that situation, the problem might be the way in which they might be treated unkindly by their more affluent classmates because they don't dress as nice or whatever. I mean, I think we're all familiar with that scenario. I'm just trying to wrap my head around the situation at a place like Frank, where the norm, in a mm-hmm. sense, is this thing that to most of us is so abnormal. Mm-hmm. Is one saving grace of that is, in a sense, everybody's reality? And is there less of that kind of hierarchy of students making fun of other students for exactly these kind of reasons? Because it's a sobering, sad reality for almost everybody mm-hmm. there. Or is that still sometimes an issue somehow?
You know, I don't know that our kids actually realize that they're poor. I think that's something that I always find,
normal.
Yeah, they don't.
That absolutely, that's their normal right. to them.
Right.
So they wouldn't label themselves as that.
No, in fact, when they see a clothing drive or a food drive, they'll offer to bring in a canned good without realizing.
You ever want to meet.
Yeah, without realizing they might be getting that canned good. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't see themselves. Many of our families also are coming from other countries where they didn't have access to school at all, where they might have gone to school once a week, or the school they went to didn't have even a floor. It was just a dirt floor. So they come here in this beautiful school that's been remodeled, that's extremely bright, large windows. They don't feel poor at all. In fact, they feel very grateful that they have access to the education they have. We have smart boards in every single classroom. We have laptops and iPads. So our kids are really exposed to lots of opportunity once they walk in the door. So I think when they're in school, I don't get the sense that they feel like they're poor.
No.
There certainly are kids that have more than others or appear to have more than others. You know, families are families, and some families may use what they have to buy hair extensions or nicer clothes, and other families will use everything they have to maybe buy a piece of technology or, you know, maybe taking them to a library. So their needs are different. So sometimes you'll see that where there certainly are people that may look like they have more than others, but, you know, they pick on each other like siblings. When you're together with a group of 24 kids all day for a school year, you become like siblings and you tend to bicker and argue, but I don't really get the sense that any of them really think that they're poor. Some of them know their struggles,
right.
But
I mean, in reality, they do have a limited income. But that's we've tried to have some things in place to help them. Last year we started a bookstore, which has been really instrumental in getting books into our children's homes, and we are getting about 80 to 100 books per week into children's homes, and the children can buy the books for 50 cents a piece. We have to go out and purchase them. We buy them at anywhere, Goodwill. Mm. I mean, there's. Garage sales, we get a lot of donations. The public library's been instrumental helping us, books that they're taking off their shelves. But getting those books into the homes of our children at a reasonable rate, we just had a parent come in and buy $13 worth of books, but he had a whole stack over conferences that he's going to go home now. That would have been one book at Barnes & Noble.
Right.
So,
and by having them pay for the book, it becomes theirs and they take mm-hmm. ownership of it.
Mm-hmm.
Versus just handing them a book, which we've done for awards.
I mean,
we've got brand new books that kids can win. We also have coupons to the bookstore.
Absolutely.
So if we know there's someone really in need, we don't want to prevent them from access to the bookstore. But they come with those quarters, mm-hmm. and they're so excited every Wednesday morning that they can buy a book. Sometimes Luann will run a special, two for one.
Get a free bookmark or something to get them up there. But that's become almost my favorite time of the week, Wednesday morning. So they come in, and they are so excited to be able to buy that book for 50 cents.
Wow.
And, yeah, so we are always looking for donations to keep that running because we're going through a lot of books.
Yeah, which is a good problem to have.
Yes. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with three staff members from Frank Elementary School in Kenosha. It's a Kenosha Unified School. It's an inner city school with a very, very high poverty level among its student population, yet they, that is Frank Elementary School, managed to score the highest rating, highest possible rating of 5 stars in the most recent batch of report cards from the DPI. We have with us Heather Connolly, who is the principal there, Luann Daniels, instructional coach, and Karen Geese, who is Title I literacy coach. Heather Connolly, you've mentioned a couple of times through the course of this interview about some sort of transformation that occurred at Frank about 6 years ago. Tell us what happened 6 years ago.
So about 6 years ago, there were a group of us that were sitting around the table, and we were talking about if we could design our ideal school for Frank, what would it look like? And it just became this conversation. Friday afternoons, we'd meet in the classroom, and we'd start talking about if we could have anything we wanted, and if Frank could look any way we wanted it to be, what would that be and how would that look? And we started to do some research on different charter schools. We looked at STEM schools and green schools and Montessori schools, and we looked at project-based learning, and we also looked at exponentiary learning. And through this process, we developed the extended year calendar because we were looking at year-round schools. We adapted it to kind of meet what we were looking for. We didn't like the traditional year-round calendar, so we created our own calendar. We were hoping for a K-8 program or an extension of Frank, adding a middle school. So we started to kind of just dream big. At that same time, KUSD was going through a leadership change, and Dr. Hancock had come on board as the new superintendent, and she was coming around to schools to meet the principals, the new leaders. And I remember her sitting in my office, and she said to me, "What's your vision? What is your vision for Frank? Tell me what it is." And I took that folder out of the shelf, and I said, "Well," and I slid it across the table and said, "This is what a group of us would love to see." And actually was really hoping for her to back a charter school at that point, because I don't think I imagined that the things that we were hoping to do could actually be done in a traditional public school. So she opened up the plan, and we talked about it. It turned out her children had attended an EL school in Rochester, so she was very familiar with the network of schools. So that was an easy sell. She also was really excited to hear about the calendar and the school uniforms and all the things we were talking about. And she closed the folder, and she said, "I love it, but you're not doing a charter school. You're doing it here." And I remember just, like, trying to take a deep breath, like, whoa. and I said, "How? What?" She goes, "You got about 6 months to work on this with your team, and then we're taking it to leadership and the board. And if they approve, you got 6 months to put your plan in action." And so it was a crazy year. Karen was on maternity leave for part of that year, so I had to call her at home and say, "Guess what?" I opened my January faculty meeting and said, "Welcome to a new year," and showed them what this plan was. Dr. Hancock actually came over and talked to the staff and said, if this is something you're not on board with, she would support their move to another school, because they needed to have some choices with changing a calendar, with adding an entire instructional program. One person left. I have to say I was a little shocked. I thought it would be more. Through the years, we've had some people leave for the calendar or for other challenges, but at that point, only one person walked out. And it was a good reason. The person had been there for only a year. Their children were in college and were gone far away, and the only time they were home was June, July, and August. And and she came in and said, "It's wonderful. It's a wonderful program for Frank, but the only time I get to see my kids is summer." And
so it's not wonderful for me.
So it's not wonderful for me, but, you know, bravo to you guys. And so we went to the parents, and we spent some time with parents. They were also allowed to opt out. Initially, there were a few. I will say most of the families that chose to opt out actually lived near, their boundaries were near another school. And so for them, they really just wanted that opportunity to, for example, the Frank boundaries go all the way to Brass, which, so for some of our families, they live across the street from Brass, but they actually come to Frank. Right. So some of those families were like, you know, this might be a chance to get to go to Brass. So so we opened up in 2007 with a new calendar, a new instructional program, being a part of a new network of schools, school uniforms. And the only thing we didn't get was the K-8. And the reason for that was our gymnasium is also our cafeteria. So Pat Fenimore from facilities came over and walked through the building, and we looked at options. But there was really no way to run a lunch program for that many grade levels and a gym program. Mm. So that was really the only thing we didn't get was the middle school that we
Everything
wanted.
Everything else, though. Real quick, what does it mean to be part of this network of EL?
So when you're in this network of schools, you create an MOU, memo of understanding, and with that you choose to hire a school designer, and you can decide how many days you want. You create a leadership team, and you write a three-plan goal every summer. So usually a 2 to 2.5 day retreat where we look at data and surveys and staff input, and we meet with teams of people, and we create this goal for the year. So it's three parts. One part is our crew character behavior goal. The other part is called mastery of knowledge and skills, which is math and reading, which is definitely where my two friends work pretty hard. And the third goal is called high quality work. And that goal is focused around kids as fine arts, as kids who are musicians and artists and writers and thinkers. And so it's a way to really develop the whole child. So it's not just, kids aren't just math and reading. That's very important. But they also have to be members of society, and they have to have behavior that will allow them to get a job. And they also have to be able to shine with what are their inner talents. And so we write these goals, and we spend a whole year on professional development. The school designers come to school, and they coach me. They coach the teachers. They help us with doing walkthroughs and peer observations. There's a ton of training. We have a crew team and a curriculum team. We meet with our morning meetings. We have a community circle every month. So it's just a really a transformation of the culture and the instruction of the whole building.
And you have a great report card to indicate
and
how
there's
successful.
Seven, yeah, there's seven schools in KUSD, and they all did very well.
Wow.
So,
Lou Ann Daniels, you're what's called an instructional coach. So give us a sense of what you do.
Okay. Well, like Heather just mentioned, we have a leadership team at Frank Elementary. And we determine, based on our data, what we need to focus on for the following year. So when I engage teachers in coaching cycles, we take a look at their student data in their particular classroom, and we decide, we come up with a plan together. And we come up with a schedule to co-teach. It's a complete partnership with the teachers in the classroom. So for 6 weeks, we will just focus in on what do their kids really need to know, and how are we going to get them there? And then we'll do the pre-assessment, we'll do the post-assessment so that we know we're actually making progress with our students. We want our students to gain as much, obviously, academically as other schools in the area. Whether or not they're poverty, we hold our students to the same expectations. So sometimes we feel like we are really working hard because we have a lot more ground to cover. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we have to take a few steps back before we can go forward. But again, I guess, you know, our whole coaching structure, that's the whole outcome is that student achievement. And sometimes, you know, knowing that, looking at that data helps us to figure out we have to differentiate for our students because we have them all over the board. And getting teachers on board to create instructional materials so that they meet the readiness needs of their students at all of those levels, not just like right down the middle. Mm. It's not that easy, so.
Mm. Karen Geese. What does it mean to be a Title I literacy coach?
The Title I literacy coach position is very similar to Luann's position. I also do six-week student-centered data cycles with the teachers and coaching. And again, like Luann said, that we choose a focus in the area of literacy. It's all about student achievement. We look at the data. And then for 6 weeks, the teacher and I work together. We co-teach. I model. And then we track our progress at the end of 6 weeks. Every staff in our building goes through a cycle for the year. And I think Luann and I went to an EL education seminar 4 years ago and came up with this coaching plan and presented it to Heather. So we found great success. I think it's a main factor that's driving our student achievement, that we're able to close that gap. Through EL Education, our work plan is very purposeful and defined and focused. So it has allowed us to look at our standards across every grade level and really hone on where our students are and where they need to be. Because like Luann said, we have the highest expectations, just like every building, but it does take us longer sometimes to get there and definitely harder work.
I think it's important, too, just if I could add, these two ladies meet with me once a week in a coaching meeting. We go over grade level planning notes. We go over our PD notes, professional development. Karen does reading groups. Luann does some math groups with kids that we need to accelerate, kids that are above grade level. They also have to deal with all of the testing. They set up the math testing, the state testing, the PALS assessment. That's maybe not the funnest part of their job. The coaching is certainly the part they love the most. But, you know, when new curriculum comes in the building, these are the two ladies to make sure it gets to every classroom. They are the ones to make sure the schedules are set up, the testing is done. They do all the makeup testing. We have PALS, MAP, Access, Forward. They run all of that assessment.
Quarterly benchmarking.
Quarterly benchmarking district. For guided reading. Every teacher has a data wall. They help monitor that data wall. They help make sure that the teachers have the data in there. When we have a teacher that goes out on FMLA, whether it's for illness or maternity, they're the ones in there supporting the sub. If we have a teacher, a new teacher, these are the two people in there making sure they're set up with reading centers and math centers. So that's not the most glamorous part of their job, but it's pretty critical to making sure a building runs. I don't think people always understand that when they see the title of what is an instructional coach. It's certainly the number one priority is coaching teachers and supporting the learning of students, but they also do so much with the data. You don't see these two ladies where they're not running around with a cart or a set of books, or, you know, if we're doing an expedition, which is a big part of EL, which is a huge work case study, and they're the ones helping to get materials for that and setting up field work and bringing in experts. So really the day-to-day running of everything instructionally comes to me but falls on these two, and then I get the credit for their work.
Is that how it goes?
But you have our vision, okay. Heather. She keeps our school vision.
But they run the instructional team for sure. And then we have a dean of students who couldn't be here today because he's actually at Harborside training and learning himself. But so we have an instructional team, and then we have a behavior crew team. And our dean of students runs that part of the program. So,
well, it's just an amazing success story, and success not easily earned, but earned the hard way, that's for sure. But one also has to hope that if this can happen at Frank, it can happen at other schools that for a variety of reasons are struggling. And this is one of the biggest reasons why we wanted to be sure to hold up the story of Frank Elementary School to the community at large and to communities beyond, in the hope that you can be an inspiration to other schools who are desperate to achieve the same kind of success that you have at Frank Elementary School. Heather Connolly, the principal there, Luann Daniels, instructional coach, Karen Geese, Title I literacy coach, I really do appreciate you taking the time out of such busy schedules, out of your very busy lives, to be part of the morning show. And we wish you only further success and more triumphant report cards for your students at Frank Elementary. And thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I'm Gregory Berg. Next week on The Morning Show, a very interesting lineup of programs, I think, beginning on Monday with Carthage College sociology professor Wayne Thompson. He studies to quite an extent, in a sense, the demographics of our nation. Who are we as a country? And we're going to explore some questions such as, are we more divided now than we once were? In what ways are we divided? Along what lines? And what are the possibilities for drawing this country into a more cohesive unity? On Tuesday, David France, who's spectacularly important and successful new book is called How to Survive a Plague. It's already regarded as the definitive account of the early years of the AIDS epidemic. On Wednesday, we talk about the potato, first with Raghavan Iyer, a renowned cookbook author whose latest book is all about the potato. And we'll talk with a local man who is renowned for his raising of potatoes and garlic as well, Curzio Caravati. Many of you know him from